All right, everybody, welcome back to the Weekend Interview Show. I'm your host, Philip Drew, administrator, and our next guest is Doug Rocky. He's an expert on depleted uranium. Now, Mr. Rocky, usually I like to go on and give a big introduction, but since the topic today is science, I think it'd probably be better if you went ahead and gave everybody all your credentials and descriptions and stuff so that we're very clear about who you are and what your background is.
Okay, well, my name is Doug Rocky. I've been a physicist for many, many years. I earned my Bachelor of Science at Western Illinois University, went on to get a Master of Science and PhD at the University of Illinois in Physics and Technology Education. I'm a science teacher. I've been in the military, joined the military back in 1967, served in the Air Force as avionics expert, bomb navigation on B-52s, went on to be a frontline combat medic, and then finally got commissioned as a direct commission in the U.S. Army and Medical Service Corps as a health physicist back in 86. Specialized in nuclear biology, chemical warfare during Gulf War I. I was a member of the team that had overall responsibility for teaching, preparing, ensuring our troops were prepared and could respond to the use of nuclear biological chemical warfare. Went on to have the responsibility for cleaning up the depleted uranium mess following Gulf War I in the desert. And then in 94 and 95, I went on to become a director of the depleted uranium project for the Department of the Army, who turned out to be the whole Department of Defense, and ended up as a NATO project. Served as a professor teaching environmental science and engineering, worked for the Department of Transportation as an expert in environmental science, Department of the Army as an environmental specialist, so I've been around.
Yeah, it sounds like you know a little bit about the scientific method and mathematics and stuff.
I'm more a hands-on guy. You know, one of those scientists that actually goes out there in the field and cleans it up, blows it up, and finds out what happens.
So, what was your experience in the first Gulf War? I mean, apparently you said you helped clean up the depleted uranium mess after the first Gulf War, but then you continued working for the Department of Defense through the mid-90s when you did this test for, I guess you said it started out as an Army test and ended up becoming a NATO test. And so I wonder, what was your experience after the first Gulf War, and why is it that it took you till 1995 or so before you decided that this depleted uranium was something that something had to be done about?
Well, in beginning of Gulf War I, basically nobody knew anything about depleted uranium munitions. They decided to use them, but they hadn't taught anybody anything about the medical care required for exposures, how to clean up the radiological contamination that's left all over the desert, had not planned how to dispose of all the destroyed equipment. And in March of 1991, right after the ground war, February-March of 91, Schwarzkopf ordered me to clean up the depleted uranium mess. To this day, I have no idea why I was selected, other than probably strong background for many, many years in the military. Back in 1990, you got to remember, I enlisted in 1967. Most people's career ends after 20 years, and, well, it hasn't ended yet. But what we found could be summed up in three words: oh, my God. The use of solid uranium munitions, which are basically a solid projectile, a solid dart of uranium-238. You have to understand, each individual tank round is over 10 pounds of solid uranium. They're not coated, they're not tipped, they're 10 pounds of solid uranium. The A-10 fires a round, each individual round is 3/4 pound of solid uranium. And the A-10 fires at a rate of 4,000 rounds a minute. That's a ton and a half of solid uranium. When this impact, it's catastrophic destruction, causes secondary detonations beyond comprehension. It's a magic bullet, a silver bullet. It flies through the air at extreme high velocity, has high density, very a lot of weight over a very small area, punches through everything. Because uranium is pyrophoric, you have a firestorm, a shower of burning uranium fragments inside that cause catastrophic detonations and catastrophic injuries.
Is that why it's such a good weapon?
Yeah, it kills and destroys everything. You've got to understand the purpose of war, the purpose of the military is to kill and destroy, period.
Well, I mean, what's so much better about a depleted uranium round than tungsten or whatever else
well,
there is?
It's mainly pyrophoric in the fact that it breaks up and catches fire. And then you got a higher density, okay? So when this round strikes anything, and it doesn't have to be a tank, it could be a car, it could be a building, it could be a wooden house, it could be a sandbag bunker. It's awesome. This stuff just literally kills and destroys. The purpose is to defeat the enemy, to destroy the enemy's stuff. Well, what happened in Gulf War One is most of the injuries and casualties and deaths that occurred during Gulf War One were due to friendly fire through the use of uranium munitions, where U.S. troops fired on other U.S. troops and caused death and injury, and did the same thing on the British. And obviously, you know, the Iraqis, you know, were devastated. But the contamination that remains, which we knew was going to be there forever unless you cleaned it up, is had a catastrophic health effects on the general population of Iraq, Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, the Balkans, Afghanistan, and lo and behold, Vieques, Puerto Rico, but also right over here south of Indianapolis, north of in Jefferson Proving Grounds, and out in Nevada, Florida. Every place this stuff been used.
So did this "oh my God" conclusion of yours take place in 91 in the desert in Iraq, or not until after the studies in the mid-90s?
Well, the "oh my God" took place right away, but again, we were senior military officers tasked to clean up a mess, and we did our job. The problem was that we all got sick within 72 hours of starting to do our job, because the gas masks that were issued to us then, that are still issued to the troops today, are totally ineffective. The particles that are emitted when the round blows up, actually, you know, causes a secondary detonation and everything, are smaller than the gas mask filters will take out. And they go right into the body and cause all kinds of health effects. So myself and my team all started to get sick within a couple, 2 to 3 days, and nobody's ever been well since. And then the health effects started showing up on everybody. First cancers on our team were within 9 months. First deaths from cancer, lung cancer, within 2 years. And everybody continues to get sick to this day.
So what was the study in the mid-90s? Where did it take place, and what were you doing there? Just blowing up and running around?
Yeah, what had basically happened, during Gulf War I had the responsibility to identify, collect, secure, decontaminate, process, and dispose of all the United States' depleted uranium-contaminated equipment. Those were Abrams, tanks, and Bradley fighting vehicles. We shipped a whole bunch back to the United States, and I buried a whole bunch in the desert in northern Saudi Arabia, okay, with the remaining body parts because I couldn't get them out. And the other contamination unexploded ordnance. And they were just too totally destroyed to bring back. Those 24 vehicles came back, were taken to Barnwell, South Carolina, at the Defense Consolidation Facility, and took the U.S. military, the Department of Defense, that very specialized facility, the only facility of its kind in the world, a multi-million-dollar facility, all, you know, ran by scientists and engineers, 3 years to process 24 vehicles. Thousands and thousands have been left to cross the desert in Iraq and now been in Gulf War II, Afghanistan, the Balkans, Vieques, Okinawa, and every other place. Now, based on all of that information in our reports, we started in 1992. We got another directive through the U.S. Army to the United States Army Environmental Policy Institute, and we started a study on the health and environmental consequences of uranium on the battlefield. That directive, congressional directive, signed by the Assistant Secretary of the Army, told us very specifically to figure out ways to reduce the toxicity of uranium munitions. They knew they'd been toxic all along, and we've known that forever and ever and ever. And total documentation verifies that as far back as October of 1943 that I can absolutely document.
Help me understand the difference between toxicity from the radiation from the uranium-238 versus just heavy metal toxicity that would be the same problem if you had lead in your system or anything else.
Well, I mean, you know, either one, they're heavy metal toxicity. So eating uranium dust would be the same thing as eating lead dust, except the toxicity is a little bit different. You also have the radiation effects, okay? So you not only have the alpha particles, which would be like taking and throwing a giant beach ball down a bowling alley and knocking over all the pins, because that's what an alpha particle does. It destroys 5 to 7 cell thicks. Horrible damage. Horrible chromosomal aberrations, which are actually proven to have happened today in Gulf War I vets and others. So what you have is you have, first off, with uranium, you have the particulates, very fine particulates. That'd be going like out in the field and eating dirt and dust on a dusty day, you all get sick. Or in a dusty building, you get sick. Okay, but that happens to everybody. And then you have that particulates damaging the lungs and causing all kinds of respiratory problems away. Then you have the heavy metal toxicity. This is like eating a whole bunch of lead dust. This would be like taking and making Kool-Aid. Instead of using sugar, using solid lead dust. But in this case, they use uranium. And you inhale that, ingest it, you absorb it into your skin, and you get sick. And then over a period of time, all of the ionizing radiation, the alpha particles, cause horrible damage. So in the lungs, what you see is calcified granulomas and lung damage, and people don't breathe very well anymore, and the cancers start. And then because of the chromosomal aberrations that are happening, they absolutely proven in the Gulf War I veterans, especially the friendly fire, where you have the uranium in the semen, we see all the birth defects. But this stuff is all mixed not just with the uranium, it's mixed with all the other toxic industrial materials, all the organic, inorganic compounds that are blown up and destroyed whenever you blow something up. So you got a total toxic soup that they were exposed to, in addition to all the other toxic materials that come about from war that make people sick.
So the human body won't get rid of this. It builds up and stays in the human body.
Well, what will happen with uranium, the body does remove a portion of it, but a large portion of it goes in what we call sequestering. It goes into the bone, goes into the various organs, and it sits here and causes continuous damage. Now, a fraction of it will be metabolized out through the urine. But what happened with, in my case, and other team members, is that uranium started to metabolize out and precipitate down in the kidneys and form kidney stones. And then we try to use the common techniques of shockwave lithotripsy. You couldn't break up the uranium stone. And because of an alpha particle, what you end up is uranium fragments embedding in the kidney tissue, and there's no way to remove the stone unless you literally remove portions of the kidney.
Well, in the past, let's see, since 1991, there's been all sorts of allegations about various Gulf War syndromes and illnesses. There's been accusations about pills that were taken that supposedly were to protect our soldiers from chemical weapons. There's been accusations about exposure of some of our troops to sarin gas after they blew up the Kamacia weapons bunker in southern Iraq. There's been accusations of germs inside tainted anthrax vaccines. There's been all sorts of different explanations for various symptoms of different Gulf War illnesses among veterans who have come back. And I think clearly some of these are total fiction. Some of them perhaps have some truth to them. And I would really like to be convinced, Mr. Rocky, that this the depleted uranium explanations for sicknesses of Gulf War veterans is... I'd like to be convinced that these accusations are more credible than some of the others.
Well, first off, let's look at all the other ones. Okay, number one, when we went to war, individuals were given a whole bunch of immunizations simultaneously, all different types of immunizations simultaneously. We're taking 6 to 8 shots within minutes of each other. No physician would ever administer 6 to 8 shots simultaneously of all different types of, active, viruses and things. In other words, protect a person from diseases. So the immune system was compromised. Then we had what you refer to as the nerve gas pills. Well, those are actually pyridostigmine bromide. Those are actually, if you go to a physician's desk reference, mestinone, M-E-S-T-I-O-N-E, and that itself is pesticide. It's a chlorinitrate inhibitor, and what that means is it's a pesticide. It'd be taken, like if you take gumdrops or, any gumdrops or candy, and soak them in Raider Black Flag and ate them. So, yeah, people got sick, and over 50% of the people that took that got sick. Then we had total misuse of pesticides. This is not questions. This is verified. So these are not accusations. And when you started mixing the misuse of pesticides, and soldiers were wearing flea collars with the mestinone, you started getting sick, and we saw the neurological problems, and we reported those at the theater command staff immediately to General D.G. Zulus, the theater medical commander, and we held all kinds of courses on it. Then you had the deliberate destruction of Iraq's chemical and biological stockpiles. You have to understand, the United States gave those to Iraq. That's verified in the Regal Commission report, prepared for the Senate Banking Commission. It was the subject of a movie we did called Thanks for Grateful Nation, starring Ted Danson and Mark Helgenberg. No question about it. So we not only blew up Kamacia, we deliberately blew up over 105 other sites. That was from the beginning of the war through the fall of 1991.
And we just blew those sites up with plain old conventional TNT instead of some sort of high-tech incineration or napalm or something that would be sure to destroy all the germs and chemicals.
Yeah, and all that happened is we spread them all over the place. Now, you can go to General Norman G. Schwarzkopf's autobiography, It Doesn't Take a Hero. Go to page 390 and read about our decision. It's right there. And so people got sick. And then we had carc paint, which was, again, toxic components when it sprayed on and people got sick. Then we had all the oil well fires, complex inorganics, organic compounds, heavy metals, carcinogens were released by the incomplete combustion of the oil fires, and people got sick. We reported that immediately to the DG Zulus and up to Schwarzkopf and everybody else. No question about it. And people got sick. And then we had the continuation of all use of hazardous materials. Just like any industry, any city, any community, they use all kinds of hazardous materials to maneuver and function. And that stuff was dumped all over and released. I'll give you an example. I think it was late March, early April, General Franks, the commander of 7th Corps at that time, not the same General Franks that just did, you know, the new war, but a different General Franks. We had to go clean up the 7th Corps hazardous waste dump up in Iraq. People were sick and it was all over the place. And then when we blew up Iraq's infrastructure, when Iraq blew up Kuwait's infrastructure, when we blew up Kuwait's infrastructure, and then obviously Saudi Arabia didn't have a good day in certain areas, we released all the toxic industrial chemicals that are used in industry, agriculture, medicine, and education. And that went all over everybody. Then on top of that, we absolutely knew that Iraq had anthrax, okay, weaponized anthrax. Again, the U.S. Army had given it to them. This is in the RICO Commission report. Absolutely verified. And so we had to use the immunization. Well, because we didn't have enough active vaccine of the anthrax vaccine, they put squalene as the adjuvant instead of alum, which gave for every, you know, normally you take, say, 50 microliters of anthrax vaccine for one shot. Well, when you used squalene instead of alum, you only needed one microliter instead of 50. A 50-to-1 ratio improvement. And people got sick. So it was a whole complex toxic mess. And then we had all the fine sand and dust. It was all contaminated, and the fine sand just getting into the lungs. And this is called LSCAN disease that Colonel Andres Carnegie Boff, Dr. MD, wrote up and totally researched and verified. And he's still working on it to this day. So it was a toxic waste. When you go to war, the weapons you use release all kinds of toxic materials. And conventional munitions release all kinds of heavy metals, nitrates and sulfites, that you don't want to breathe in. You don't want to get into your body. You don't want to drink. You don't want to inhale. You don't want to ingest. Then on top of this, we had all the uranium munitions. Now, it's absolutely legendary about all the adverse health effects at Paducah, Kentucky, Oak Ridge, Tennessee, Portsmouth, Ohio. You look up at King up in Massachusetts. Look at Kentucky, where they've been doing the uranium munitions weapons development and testing.
Well, forgive me, Mr. Rocky, but legendary isn't science. And
legendary is the legendary in the medical files, the medical records of all these people that are sick.
Okay, well, I went to the British Ministry of Defense yesterday, and they assured me that depleted uranium is 40% less radioactive than naturally occurring uranium, which is all over the place, they say. They use it all the time to shield X-ray technicians. That they have a bunch of friendly fire victims who actually still have depleted uranium shrapnel in their bodies who are not sick at all.
Well, that's an absolute lie.
Ministry of Defense.
That's an absolute lie. Because first off, when they say it's 40% radioactive, they delete the other half of the paragraph that I wrote. Uranium-238, which is depleted uranium, is 99.98% uranium-238. That's an alpha emitter. It also has beta and gammas. Once you get into the body, the alpha part is terrible damage. Now, when you remove the very small fraction of U-234 and 235 that are fissionable, that removes a lot of the gammas and beta particles. But the alphas, which are 99%, over 99% of what it was to begin with, are horrible inside the body. So the British Ministry of Defense, or U.S. Department of Defense, says that the individuals are not sick. You need to understand. They're lying. Because I'm one of the individuals, absolutely affected, absolutely confirmed, along with the other individuals.
And when,
so when you go to the medical records, the actual medical records, you find all of the health effects. Not what you end up seeing where these people are absolutely trying to sustain the use of uranium munitions as directed. Back many times, 1991 and December of 1992. In March of 1991, I received a directive from Los Alamos written by Colonel Michael Zinn, stated very specifically we should lie about what the health and environmental effects of uranium munitions in order to sustain their use. And then in December of 1992, when we got the directive, again, from the assistant secretary of the Army, Walker, he told us very specifically, figure out ways to reduce the toxicity of uranium munitions. And we said, we can't do it.
And PS,
they said, no, no matter what, we're going to keep using them.
By the way, for the people in the audience, if you go to the Canadian Broadcasting System or whatever, type in CBC and Silver Bullet in your Google search, and you'll be able to find... what's the name of the channel again? The Canadian Broadcasting...
What? Canadian Broadcasting Corporation.
Oh, Corporation. I was thinking,
yeah, CBC and then the Silver Bullet.
The last C was for... And they have links there to the Los Alamos memo and the Defense Nuclear Agency memo that Mr. Rocky just referred to.
You can also go to the www.traprockpeace.org website, and you can pull up the Thane Groves Memorandum along with lots of other documents. And the Groves Memorandum very specifically said it would cause the adverse health effects within 24 hours. And exactly what was predicted in 1943, what happened to myself and my team members. You've got to understand, you can't take solid radioactive material, solid radioactive dust, inhale, ingest it, absorb it, or eat it, or get it into a wound. It's going to cause health effects. Well, they say the big difference, well, natural uranium is all over the place. Yeah, it is all over the place in parts per million and parts per billion in the soil. Not solid piles of solid uranium. Okay? That's a big difference. You've got to understand, where you would go out to your backyard or all over, you're not going to be able to detect the uranium in the soil. When you fire it, you leave a pile of uranium solid there, dust and particles. It's like in the memorandum I received from the Defense Nuclear Agency, also in March of 1991. Colonel Greg Lyle stated very specifically that it's not only a health risk, it's a serious health threat. And everything we've done has absolutely proven that. I mean, we've got to think about this. What right does the United States, England, or Australia, or any other nation have to take tons and tons of solid uranium-238, radioactive waste, and throw it in somebody else's backyard and refuse to provide medical care that they themselves require and direct it should be done, and they've never complied with, and they also require to be cleaned up, and they've never done? Who wants hundreds and hundreds of pounds of solid uranium in their backyard or in their playground or in their school or in their house? I don't. This is common sense.
Well, and this administration has turned over an American citizen to a Navy brig on the accusation that he was planning on setting off a dirty bomb in this country.
And the United States has used dirty bombs all over the world and throughout the United States on its own citizens. Okay, first off, the radiological dirty bomb. The uranium route, as you got to understand, is a dirty bomb. What you're doing is taking an individual tank round is 10 pounds of solid uranium-238. Contaminated with plutonium, neptunium, and americium. These are also very toxic. Okay? And we fire that at something, and we not only fire just one round, we usually fire two to three at a given vehicle. You got, 20 to 30, maybe 40 pounds of solid uranium left laying there. That vehicle is all contaminated. The particles will break up about 40% of that gets into fine oxide, dust that you can breathe in, you can get into the water and the soil and get into it and get sick. And then you have all the contaminated equipment and solid rods of uranium left laying there. A giant dart, like a giant broom handle, left laying there in somebody's backyard. You can't take even one solid rod of uranium and just throw it any place here in the United States without going to jail. For example, the National Lead Site in Albany, New York, was closed down almost 20 years ago because they released the equivalent of two uranium penetrators from an A-10, a total of less than a pound and a half. The contamination from that site was absolutely verified, scientifically verified, by Dr. Lendich, who had gone to a U.S. Navy nuclear facility 30 miles away in sufficient quantity to cause adverse health effects. Not a question. So when I talk about legendary, I'm talking about medical records, autopsies, health effects, looking at it for real. What right does anybody to take solid uranium-238, solid uranium contaminated, and throw it in somebody else's backyard and refuse to do medical care and clean it up? The medical directives for medical care for U.S. casualties. I issued the first directive right away in February, March of 1991. The theater medical commander issued a written medical directive to provide medical care for all DU casualties in June of 1991. In June of 1993, the Deputy Secretary of Defense ordered the Secretary of the Army to do it. In August of 1993, General Erich Shinseki, who was the general leading the whole army here for this last war, ordered everybody to do it, and it was never done. In October of 1993, we were going to use uranium in Somalia and Africa, the Horn of Africa. We got that stopped, but we did get a medical directive requiring medical care within 24 hours for anybody that's within a vehicle, building, or structure that's hit with uranium munitions, that works in any uranium-contaminated area, or is downwind of any uranium dust that's blown up. And it's not been complied with. In 1998, the Special Assistant for Gulf Oil, this is Dr. Michael Kilpatrick, Dr. Bernard Rosker, Dr. General Jeff Prather, told the Presidential Oversight Board, just like Bill Clinton, you know, like one each President of the United States, that they knew there were 324 of us that required medical care from Gulf War One, but, hey, they'd only notified a little over 100 people as of 1998. And we can't get medical care to this day.
Yeah, they still say it's a psychosomatic problem. You're just stressed out.
Yeah, it's not a psychosomatic problem. You don't get high levels of uranium, excreting high levels of uranium in your urine and finding uranium deposit in your bones psychosomatically. It doesn't happen that way. You don't get these extremely high levels of uranium in your body. You don't see all these adverse health effects, respiratory, kidney, rashes, cancers, birth effects, psychosomatically, especially when you absolutely verify the uranium is in the body. It's like in Afghanistan. The United States used uranium munitions in Afghanistan here recently. Dr. Asif Durakovich, who is actually the U.S. Army's former U.S. Army's expert, Colonel Asif Durakovich, and a physician and a scientist, verified that the Afghan populations were excreting uranium at 5,000 to 7,000 times permissible level. It didn't come from anything in the environment because they checked it. It came from uranium munitions, and people were sick. This is a kind of common sense. You know, you take solid uranium munitions, you spread it all over, you contaminate air, water, and soil. You contaminate all kinds of equipment and building structures. Those building structures are then recycled. Say, for example, we had some destroyed armor and metal that was recycled from Gulf War I, Iraq, okay? That stuff showed up in car bumpers in Marion, Illinois. No question. Showed up in U.S. Navy cooking pots. No question. Radiologically contaminated metal that should not have any radioactive isotopes was contaminated.
Wait, how did a cooking pot get contaminated again?
They recycled the metal from that was destroyed, recycling the metal from all destroyed equipment in Iraq during Gulf War One, and that recycled metal ended up being used to manufacture U.S. Navy cooking pots.
Oh,
I had to do the investigation for the military. Surprise! I mean, this is, you know, we got to get to common sense here. You can't take solid uranium metal and dust, inhale it, ingest it, absorb it into your body, have wounded wounds, and not get sick. It happens all over the place. When you look at Aerojet that produced uranium rounds back in 1980, 1981 in Tennessee, 60 Minutes did a story in 1981 called On Strike for Their Lives. And just in the manufacturing production, everybody was getting sick. You go up to Concord, Massachusetts, the town where our city was born, StarMet produces uranium munitions. And look at all of the illness and cancers and birth defects and respiratory and kidney problems around there. You go to Paducah, Oak Ridge, Portsmouth, where they've done it, and all the deaths, the cancers, the birth defects, the respiratory, the kidneys, the rashes, they're there.
Well, do we have studies that really show that there are a lot more cancers in these places than your average town in America? I mean, your anecdotal evidence sounds great, but I'd like to see like some real science that that really compares Paducah, Kentucky versus Anniston, Alabama, or some other
place. Well, Anniston, Alabama is contaminated wasteland.
That's burning all their chemical munitions.
And the testing of everything down there.
Okay, bad example. I was trying to just pick an American town at random. I want to see direct causation in some of these correlations is what I'm getting at here.
Well, the direct causation is one you have to understand. When you get into a lot of these areas, you're going to have complex mixtures, okay? But when you have the direct exposures and you see the direct health effects, you got a causal relationship. What happened with Gulf War I veterans, the friendly fire veterans? The United States Department of Defense and the U.S. Department of Veteran Affairs refused to provide the medical care that was required. They refused to do the testing, and the people were sick. And they continue to do that to this day. Now, am I a physician? No, I'm not a physician. One thing you'll find, I mean, it was just recently on the websites and released again on the AP a couple days ago. The Department of Energy, again, was found that they had deliberately and willfully destroyed medical records, hiding all the adverse health effects in these locations. I mean, how much you want to do? How much common sense? I mean, we've got to come down to it. You know, the bottom line, you get this stuff in and you get sick. It's only common sense medically. It's all in the medical literature. In what right does anybody have to take, you know, 1 pound of solid uranium, throw it in somebody else's backyard, just in the cause of war, and you can't do it here in this country? Now, we can argue and debate all day long about the health and environmental, and the Department of Defense says, well, follow the science. Yeah, well, we did the science, and all the documents were destroyed. And the reports were not did. We went off the National Academy of Science and presented our reports. And they said, well, we're not going to follow it because it's not peer-reviewed. Well, when you're blowing stuff up on site and you're finding out what's happening, you're seeing people get sick, it ain't like a lab experiment. This is real stuff.
Well, and it's clear that, you know, there's obviously the most powerful people in the Pentagon and civilians in the administration. I'm sure, I mean, that's beyond argument whether they would do everything in their power to stop any information about the dangerous effects of depleted uranium from being published. Because they want their weapon, pure and simple. I mean, that's easy enough to understand. But
well, there's directives to do that. You have to understand that. The Los Alamos memo, the AEPI directive, and lots of other ones. I mean, a cut and dry. Those are the written directives. They exist.
Any studies done in any other countries or anything that show some good numbers?
Yeah, we've got the studies that were Albert Schott just did over in Germany on the actual studies. I'm looking at the chromosome aberrations. We got all the work that Dr. Asadrakovich Bach has just done, and that study was just published in the recent issue of Military Medicine. Okay, brand new issue that just came out. So they're there. When you look at the actual medical records, you see the stuff coming out. Now, what you'll see over and over again, they say, well, you can't verify and prove that there are a causal relationship. Okay, therefore, we're going to continue to use it. Well, sometimes you got to say stop. I got to ask anybody, how many people listening to this show want 1 pound, much less 100 tons of solid uranium dust and solid uranium fragments, giant darts, in their backyard? And if you don't, then you better stand up and say no. You know, one thing that we've had is the whole history of the whole nuclear age going back to the, you know, back to the early 1900s. When people got exposed, they got sick. When the people did all of the work to produce nuclear weapons and nuclear bombs and reactor fuel, they got sick. You have to understand, depleted uranium is nothing but the waste byproduct of the uranium enrichment process to make reactor fuel and nuclear bombs. So when all those people that are sick at Oak Ridge and Paducah and Portsmouth, all you got to do is go look at the medical records into the areas. Okay, and I can't cite you exact things over the phone. It's too complex. There's hundreds of doctors. They're there.
Well, and in your defense, I know I'm being hard on you because I don't want to, you know, just believe. I want to know. But in your defense, Dr. Jack Zaremba, head of the Gulf War Clinic at the VA clinic in Birmingham, Alabama, has confirmed that he traces your symptoms to depleted uranium in your lungs and in your kidneys, right?
Absolutely. I mean, I've got a disability for it, VA disability. Now, you've got recently Chris Busby, Malcolm Hooper, Rosalie Bertel, and the other ones, they just completed the European Union study. It's the ICCR, European Commission on Radiation Risk. That's a brand-new publication, a brand-new study that just came out. Extensive studies. Extensive work. These are scientists that said we're going to no longer go along with the status quo. We're no longer going to go along with the lies. Because it's always been known. We know uranium-238 and the alpha particles and all that stuff, they were used in biological research, caused all kinds of health effects. It's documented back to the 50s. I mean, again, it's common sense of what's happening. When you look at the fact that the individual, say, for example, Jerry Weed, who was friendly fire casualty in Gulf War I, he was in a Bradley fighting vehicle that was hit twice by two 120-millimeter rounds fired by U.S. soldiers from an Abrams tank. That's 20 pounds of solid uranium. I directed medical care for Jerry immediately in theater. He never received it. They never even told him he was hit by friendly fire with uranium munitions. Some years later, the shrapnel was working its way out of his body, and his father, who was a scientist at Los Alamos, picked out, you know, like a sliver festering out of a wound cut, and found out it was radioactive. Jerry developed tumors around the shrapnel that was ordered left in his body by the U.S. military. Tumors around the shrapnel. And when we finally, when Jerry was able to get the, you know, Department of Veteran Affairs to remove the tumors with the embedded uranium shrapnel, the guy in charge of this at the Pentagon told Jerry and I in a meeting in Washington, D.C., we're all sitting together. Jerry's still got his arm in a sling. He's still got his sutures in his arm where they just removed the tumor with the uranium inside the tumor. And they said, Jerry, you have to prove to us that that uranium that's embedded in the tumor caused the tumor to grow around the tumor.
Yeah, there are standards of science, and then there are standards of science, right?
You know, we got a written directive that was issued in March of 1992 to deliberately leave the uranium in the soldiers to find out what would happen, to compare the clinical course, to find out what happened to all of us, the health effects of long-term exposure to uranium-238.
Pardon me, wait a minute. Let me make sure I understand you there. Now, from my research on the Internet, I found stories of guys who still have uranium shrapnel in them because the doctors decided that it would be too risky to remove it. But you're saying that you guys were specifically ordered to leave shrapnel in guys, not because taking it out would cause more of a danger, but because they wanted to study what it would be like for someone to walk around for 10 years with uranium shrapnel in them?
Absolutely. That's a written directive issued by the U.S. Army in March of 1993.
God damn it, I'm never believing anything the British Ministry of Defense says ever again.
Well, I'll tell you, Mr. Bell over the British Ministry of Defense, okay, who's in charge of them, I was over there in hearings in the British Parliament, okay, he point blank to my face told Malcolm Hooper and I, he said, the Department of Defense said there's nobody in the VADU medical program that's sick. There is nobody with adverse health effects. There are no problems. And I handed him my medical records from the VA and said, hello, then what does this say? As simple as that. A couple years ago, I went head-to-head with John Speller, you know, Minister of Defense in Great Britain, in England, in the House of Lords. We proved that he had lied to Parliament. Made the front page, you know, we made page four, which is like the front page, page four of the London Times, on February 8th of year 2001, where he had to admit he had lied.
That's funny how that wasn't on CNN.
Well, you're not going to find any of this stuff on CNN. I mean, if you go to the Department of Defense website and look on depleted uranium, you won't find Doug Rocky or Asa Durakovich, you know, or Corney Both or any of these other ones, okay? You won't find any of the actual reports. You won't find a single mention of the depleted uranium project for which I was director. You won't find any mention of the fact that all of us are sick. What you'll find is that you'll find
lie.
You're going to find the RAND report. When you look at the RAND report, and you go in there and find, well, did the RAND report actually look at any of us that were sick? Is there any? No, it did not. Look at the RAND report references. Did they actually look at any of the research from the depleted uranium project where I was the director? It's not there. Did they look at any of the original reports from the EU assessment team for which I was health physicist during Gulf War I? No, they didn't. Brian Spratt of the British Royal Society has recently, him and I were on World Radio just a few months ago or so, a couple months ago, calling for full medical care for all uranium exposures and full environmental cleanup, as is required by the Department of Defense's own written directives. And they refuse to comply. You know, and then if you want to have a real shocker, guys, all you got to do is go to the Internet, okay? Go in any search engine and type in Project Shad. P-R-O-J-E-C-T, and then capital S-H-A-D. That's deliberate use of chemical and biological warfare munitions on U.S. military personnel and U.S. citizens, which continues up to this day.
If you go to the Federal Register and look up United States Code Title 50, Chapter 32, Section 1520A and B, makes it perfectly legal for the Department of Defense to test biological and chemical weapons on American civilians as long as they notify two local officials within 30 days before the simulated attack takes place. So I guess the dog catcher and the mayor have time to leave town while the rest of us get soaked. That's Title 50, Chapter 32, Section 1520.
Now, hey, I'm going to throw a real kinker at you, okay? Go to the Regal Commission report, and you can just type in Regal Commission, Regal Report, okay, on the Internet, and go to the last item on it. you'll find West Nile virus was shipped to Iraq from the U.S. military.
Really?
Surprise.
This is the Regal Commission. This is the, what, this is what, a congressional committee or?
Congressional committee, Senator Regal out of Michigan. Again, if you want to go down to Blockbuster and rent the movie called Thanks for Grateful Nation, starring Ted Danson and Mark Helgenberger, it's all over in the movies. Actual participants are in the documentary and watch me fly by. You know, it's real neat when you have Ted Danson, you know, read lines that you wrote for a movie. It's kind of exciting. You know, go to all the other things. Look at all the documentaries we've done with the BBC, with the Canadians, that we've done on the history channels. Look at the documentaries we've done with the French, the Germans, the British, the Japanese. And when you look at all these reports and you see firsthand evidence on screen of what's happened to the people. Hello? It's sort of like somebody said, when it walks like a duck and it quacks like a duck, it's a duck. And duck starts with D-U. And when you put all these other toxic industrial chemicals, when you release all of these things, when you got all of these byproducts, conventional munitions, and you expose people to this, they're going to get sick. They've been getting sick from this for a long time.
Well, and there's already a Gulf War II illness with
well, sure there is.
Serious pneumonia syndrome.
Yeah, pneumonia my butt, okay? Colonel Andres Corny Botts wrote that up. It's called Alaskan disease. He wrote it up in Gulf War I because we saw it then. We're seeing it in Gulf War II. It's not bacterial or viral. What you're looking at is complex exposures, and it's causing all the respiratory problems, and the kids are sick and dying.
And you told me on the phone earlier in the week that all the people who were first coming down with this disease were located at the Baghdad airport, and you were saying that that mattered specifically. For what reason?
Well, a tremendous amount of uranium munitions, conventional munitions, byproducts, explosive byproducts there. There's no question about that.
Well, you mentioned about how those soldiers kind of stayed in one place and weren't...
They stayed in one place and they don't have respiratory protection. They're inhaling all this stuff and getting sick. I mean,
some of them are dead already.
Yeah, they're dead. One kid that's literally less than 15 miles from where I'm sitting right now died. He was 20 years old, healthy as a horse. And he came sick like everybody else. You have to understand, I myself got sick within 72 hours with a respiratory problem. But I was extremely healthy. And I knew what to do when we tried to do stuff. But now I got a full military disability because of it. And the doctor that first treated me is Andres Corny Botts, who wrote this up. An Army doctor. But anybody that reports this and writes this stuff up becomes persona non grata. We have to understand the byproducts of war today, when we destroy a nation's infrastructure, release all kinds of toxic industrial chemicals, inorganic compounds, organic compounds, heavy metals, radiological materials, and that gets into air, water, and soil, and it makes people sick.
But the ends justify the means. The Iraqi people are free now.
Yeah, free, free. Free. You know, they said, and the reason for going to this war is because Iraq had chemical warfare munitions they were ready to release within 45 minutes. They were deployed to the frontline troops. Let me tell you, they weren't there. Scott Ritter has said that. Hans Blix has said that. Okay, Richard Butler has said that.
Well, and they haven't found so much as a coffee can full since we've occupied the place.
That's right, and we're not going to. And when you look at it now, just think about it. If you had a foreign army that came down in Austin, Texas, occupied Austin, Texas, set up roadblocks, said you can't go from point A to point B, went into your house and started taking away your stuff, your own prized possessions, how many of those proud Texans down there, and I understand Texas is not part of the United States, it's its own country, okay? We have to understand that. They'd get pissed. And that's what we're doing. When we have deliberately blew up that nation, going back for years, then we put the sanctions in place and deliberately, willfully prevented medical supplies from getting in. Deliberately, willfully continued to prevent sanitation facilities, water treatment, and sewage sanitation from being built. And then we blew it up again. I mean, we put 700 cruise missiles in on Baghdad. And there ain't no such thing as a precision bomb. 1,000 pounds of explosives is 1,000 pounds of explosives.
Well, and they actually, by the way, they admitted that less than one-third of the bombs they dropped were actually satellite or laser-guided, and that most of them were just plain old dumb bombs.
Yeah, saturation bombing, man. I saturated bombing out of B-52s for a living back in 1969, 70, and 71. It's great, man. It kills everything. You have to understand, who wouldn't be pissed? When you go into houses and you handcuff women and put bags over people's heads, you put kids on the floor, you prevent the Shiites from doing what they want, they're going to get pissed. I would. I think every person in Austin, Texas would get pissed.
Hey, you know, all the people in Austin, Texas are pissed, and all we got to deal with is local police kicking in our doors and hassling us in the middle of the night. Just imagine a foreign army running around this neighborhood.
How about a tank busting down your door?
We've seen that 100 miles from here.
Oh, you're not too far from Waco, huh?
No, not too far.
That was kind of funny. Blow up and burn that place down, too. They should have. I mean, those guys are bad. They should have just grabbed them, you know, in a conventional, you know, police bus on the road or highway.
Oh, sure. I mean, yeah, David Koresh went gun shopping every Saturday at the local Walmart. They could have got him anytime they wanted. They wanted a raid. They wanted to kill people to be on TV and make some money. But
yeah, but whatever. You know, that's a whole other story.
Well, and actually that does kind of go to the point because, you know, when the federal government, this very same national government that's now blowing everything up over in the Middle East, when that very same national government was here laying military siege to a church full of women and children and then eventually attacking them with chemical weapons and tanks and fire, the people of Texas didn't do a goddamn thing about it except sit there and cheer it on TV. The people of Texas didn't go up there to defend those other Texans from our government. The people of Texas said, hey, TV said that these people are a marginalized group and it's okay to deprive them of life, liberty, and property without due process, so let's do it.
Well, that's what we're doing in Iraq and Afghanistan. We're getting ready to do it in Iran.
So maybe the Iraqis care more about their liberty than the people of Texas do.
I don't know. You know, I can always remember, you know, from this time that I was young many, many years ago that I ever went to the Alamo. Okay, and the Alamo's a Texas shrine. Okay, total dignity should be done there. But those people died at the Alamo for freedom, upholding the utmost thing about freedom. And that shrine today is treated as it should be. But we have to remember that no matter where we are or who we are, we have to use the same dignity for everybody. We have the same rules for everybody. We can't contaminate air, water, and soil and go to war and say the ends justify the means when we see these horrible effects. You can't go in and say, well, we're trying to give you freedom, but then refuse them, prevent them from moving around and prevent them from holding their own elections and setting up their own governments. You know, there's sometimes we just got to say something's wrong. And when we deliberately use solid uranium munitions, contaminate air, water, and soil, where we throw hundreds and hundreds of tons of solid uranium darts, a giant, giant rod of uranium, leave it in somebody else's backyard, refuse to clean up, provide medical care, that's flat wrong.
There's no policy for cleanup of any of this in Iraq right now, is that right?
Well, you know, the policy was written because I wrote it for the Department of Defense, and it absolutely exists. Okay, the procedures and techniques were all verified. I did the research on this at Nevada Test Site, Mercury, Nevada. We blew stuff up and we burned stuff up and we figured out how to clean it up. But we found out real fast, you got so much of it just from a single incident that it's practical, it would be impossible to clean it up when you destroy a whole nation. And use not just where we're talking about 100 pounds, we're talking about hundreds of tons. You know, in Gulf War One, we left over 350 tons of solid uranium in the desert over there.
Estimated over 500 tons this time.
Yeah, the British Royal Society, Brian Spratt, estimates well over 500, probably close to 1,000. Afghanistan was over 1,000. The Balkans, we did that multiple times, probably 30 to 50 tons multiple times, 94 and 95, and then again 99. Okinawa, we did it in 95 and 96. That's why they're pissed. Yeah, U.S. shot up their place with uranium munitions. They refused to tell them for a year, refused to clean it up, even though I told them to clean it up within 24 hours.
Did you say at Okinawa?
Absolutely. And then Vieques, Puerto Rico, the U.S. went down there and shot that place up with uranium munitions for years. And then in preparation for Kosovo in February of 99, they went down there and shot it up. I tried to activate the U.S. Army's contaminated equipment recovery team to clean it up, and I was refused permission all the way up to the Deputy Secretary of Defense. I tried to activate medical care for the residents of Vieques. The Amateur Center, U.S. citizens, Americans, and that medical care is still being denied. The environmental cleanup procedures are in place, and they're still refusing to clean up Vieques as we speak. And that's the same thing right over here in Jefferson Proving Ground in Indiana. The U.S. military, about a month and a half ago, the Army went to the Department of Nuclear Regulatory Commission and tried to get exemption from cleanup over there because it's too dangerous to go into Jefferson Proving Grounds to clean up all of the uranium munitions and all the other explosives that are left there. But all they got is a chain link fence around there saying, contamination. Don't go by the chain link fence. Don't go by the chain link fence. In the meantime, all the residents over there are sick.
Yeah, it's too dangerous to clean, but it's not dangerous enough to stop using.
That's correct. That's documented fact.
Good old
government. When you have absolute directives requiring medical care within 24 hours for all U.S. caches and exposed uranium munitions, that medical care should be given to all coalition partners, our allies. But under Geneva Convention, it must be given to all the enemy. But under God, it must be given to all of the noncombatants around the world where it's used. Well, to this day, I can't even get the medical care from the majority of U.S.-friendly fire casualties that uranium munitions used by U.S. troops hit U.S. troops during friendly fire in Gulf War I. And I sure can't get it for anybody else. Now, the United Nations has called for total cleanup and medical care. The British Royal Society has called for cleanup and medical care. The United Nations ruled in 1996 that uranium munitions are illegal weapons of war because they're indiscriminate. You can't clean it up and last forever. That legal opinion is solid. That's on the Internet, the United Nations Subcommittee on Human Rights. And that was just reiterated again by Karen Parker, United Nations lawyer.
Okay, Mr. Rocky.
It's Dr. Rocky. It's Dr. Rocky, by the way. It's still.
Oh, I'm sorry. Dr. Rocky.
Or Major, or whatever you want to call me.
All right, I just wanted to, real quick, we're almost out of time here, so I wanted to give you a chance to tell people about your organization and how they can get a hold of you and that kind of thing.
I don't have any organization. I'm just another individual that was in a military officer that's trying to complete his assigned job. I was ordered to clean up the uranium contamination and ensure medical care was provided. I was ordered to ensure education and training is done. I was ordered to develop all the environmental procedures. It's not being done. You know, it's myself and the other ones that have the responsibility for this for the government that are trying to ensure that it's done. We don't belong to any organization. Now, there are other organizations out there reporting our work and helping us. National Gulf War Resource Center, www.ngwrc.org, is helping. Trap Rock Peace Center up in Massachusetts, Deerfield, Massachusetts, is trying to help. www.traprockpeace.org. Campaign Against Depleted Uranium, CADU, www.cadu.org in England. The Low-Level Radioactive Campaign, that's Chris Busby's work. The United Nations Observer from Vietnam Veterans Against the War, Veterans for Peace. You know, there are a lot of people out there trying to get it cleaned up and saying, you know, maybe, this is what my contention is, today the weapons we use in war and the techniques that we use to destroy the infrastructure of a nation have made war obsolete. We can't deal with the toxic byproducts. We can't deal with all the health and environmental effects that we leave. But when we know the U.S. Department of Veteran Affairs and the Department of Defense is absolutely refusing to provide medical care to the warriors of our nation, and they're sick and dying, it's wrong. Today, the United States Department of Veteran Affairs absolutely has confirmed in their own documents that over 221,000, about one-third of Gulf War I force is now permanently disabled. Well, you got one-third of a force, and those kids could run all day and leap tall buildings in a single bound, and now they're disabled. With over 221,000, one-third of the force, there's something wrong. And that same proportion goes to all coalition allies, and it goes to the Iraqis, horrible. But we've done that to all the civilians, whether they be in Korea, where we blew up houses and killed people and refused to clean it up, Vieques, Puerto Rico, Jefferson Proving Grounds, Indiana, Concord, Massachusetts, where our nation was born, Albany, New York, Salt Lake City, Crystal River in Alaska, Anniston, Alabama, and it continues at Vieques, Puerto Rico. Sometimes we got to stand up and say no more. Because as I like to end it, you know, one of the things, and there's always a purpose and we all stretch for peace. Abraham Lincoln said at the end of the Gettysburg Address, coming from Illinois, we had to all memorize that, okay? That government of the people, by the people, and for the people shall not perish from war. It's time for us to reclaim and fulfill that obligation to make sure that governments do fulfill their ethical and moral obligations. And we need to remember that if we continue to contaminate air, water, and soil, we're going to cause harm, and we're going to kill and make the children sick. And the prophecy of the ages, the prophecy of all cultures and all religions, and that a child shall lead us to peace. Well, if the child isn't there, how will we achieve the peace that God, and when I mean God, I mean the God of all cultures and all societies and all religions, desires to occur?
Dr. Doug Roeke, thank you so much for coming on the air today.
Thank you, and you have a good day.